What are butterflies' natural enemies?
Birds and semi-radiator grills.
Today, everything you ever wanted to know about butterflies. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. We'll start the hour with a conversation with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis about the butterflies of Iowa. The conversation was recorded in front of an audience at Ryman Gardens in Ames earlier this week. Then later in the hour, horticulturist Richard Duran and entomologist Ken Holscher will be here to answer your questions about the plants and bugs in your life. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day, and this conversation was recorded with a live studio audience at Ryman Gardens in Ames. And at Ryman Gardens in Ames, there is a beautiful conservatory filled with butterflies. And with me is Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Hello, Donald.
Good to be here, Charity.
And not all of the butterflies here at Ryman Gardens are native Iowa species, of course. But I do want to focus on the butterflies that live among us in Iowa. Approximately how many species are there in the state?
Depends on who you ask, of course, and the answer to all of life's tough questions is it depends. So that's the first answer. But on a regular basis, there's anywhere from 12 to 25 that we can count on seeing. But if you add up all the butterflies that have ever been seen in Iowa, including a few tropicals that get blown here on storms, it's closer to 125 different species of insects. Just the butterflies. Now, that's out of maybe 20,000 species of insects we have in the state. So the butterflies really aren't a very big part of our insect collection here in the state, but they're certainly one of the most attractive and the one that people recognize.
Well, definitely. And they're an insect that people really get excited about.
Well, right now, people are excited about two different insects, the honeybees and the butterflies. Those are the ones that tend to occupy a lot of our time, in part because both of them are with us all the time. We think of them as our friends and neighbors, and the news is that both of those are in decline and having trouble. So the question comes up quite a bit. What's happening to the butterflies? What's happening to the honeybees and the other pollinators?
And research shows that more than a quarter of the butterfly species in Iowa are endangered, threatened, or species of special interest. Is that a recent development, or has this been an issue for a long time?
Depends on what you mean by recent. If you're talking the last 12,000 years since it's been a prairie, no. But if you're talking about the last couple hundred years since we plowed up and destroyed those prairies, yes. We have been diminishing the habitat that the different species of butterflies depend upon. There are some prairie species of butterflies and skippers that are that require a specific plant. And when we plow that plant under, it's gone, and then those butterflies that depended upon it are gone as well. Many of these things disappeared because we weren't looking for them, we weren't looking at them, we weren't paying as much attention as we should have. And as we find specialists who are willing to devote the time on hands and knees down on the ground, looking at these plants, looking at the insects that are depending on those plants, we keep learning more.
We talk a lot about the monarch butterfly, mm-hmm. which is a species that people have a lot of affection for. Mm-hmm. And do you think that the monarch gets just a lot more attention than the other butterfly species?
It certainly deserves the attention it gets because of its uniqueness. It's a migrant. It can't make it through the winters, and like a lot of Iowans, it goes south for the winter and survives very well down in central Mexico as long as the forests of Mexico are preserved and as long as there's not bad ice storms and mudslides in the area where they're hibernating through the winter. It's also one that people recognize. It's an easy butterfly to recognize. You hate to use the term poster child, but it really does capture the imagination because of these 3,000-mile trips that it makes. The fact that we raised the grandchildren of the butterflies that we sent south. There are all these things that just seem so improbable that make it a fun story to talk about. It makes it an interesting story to talk about. And it's one that people can grab a hold of and feel good about. if we mentioned some other tiny pale butterfly that people don't recognize, it wouldn't have the same impact. So charismatic megaflora is, or megafauna is a term we use to describe those things that capture our attention, and the monarch certainly fits that bill.
I think every week on Horticulture Day now, we get at least one question about planting milkweed. A lot of people are very concerned about the fact that the monarch butterfly is decreasing. And on this program, you have in the past described the monarch butterfly as circling the drain as a species. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a very, very frightening situation. I mean, do you think that individuals planting milkweed, do you think that that can make enough of a difference for the monarch?
For the last 20 years, the abundance of milkweed in field crops in Iowa has declined dramatically, to the point that fields of finding milkweed in the field is hard to do. It's still in the roadsides and other places, so there's still milkweed out there. But across the Corn Belt, we've lost something like 125 million acres where milkweed was occasionally allowed to grow, but now doesn't exist at all. Planting milkweed in my little part of the backyard, the little piece of earth that I own, is not going to make up for the loss of these millions of acres, but it's what we can do. And there are lots of programs for milkweed conservation and milkweed monarch conservation. One of them is called the Monarch Wayside Program, where you plant milkweeds and other diversity of blooming flowers, the nectar-producing flowers, and for your little $16 donation to Monarch Watch, you get a sign that says, I am part of the solution. I'm doing what I can to help. But we're up to a few thousand of these milkweed way stations now that have been registered with Monarch Watch, and that's a small drop in the bucket of what we need to replace the milkweed that has been lost. And Monarch will use all kinds of milkweed. It doesn't have to be common milkweed. It can be butterfly milkweed. It can be any of the other species. So this is a growing issue, and it's a growing program with lots of attention getting to try to bring back milkweed so we can preserve the monarchs we have.
So with so many people focusing their energy on the monarch and on planting milkweed, I mean, you were talking about how this loss of diversity is affecting all of these butterfly species. Does it do any good for the other butterfly species to plant milkweed?
When milkweed flowers, it's a nectar producer that lots of different butterflies and other insects will use as an energy source. So yes, milkweed is one, but when you're thinking of feeding butterflies, you need a nectar supply through the whole summer. So it's not planting a whole big patch of one kind of flower. It's planting a biodiversity of flowers that will bloom from spring through fall and will produce nectar. And so these lists are out there. The Natural Resource Conservation Service has a list. The Xerces Society has a list of nectar-producing flowers for various regions of the country. And we need that variety of flowers through the season to keep the butterflies and the pollinators fed and happy and working for us and with us.
Now, there are a lot of people working to save the monarch. And just this spring, the Iowa Monarch Conservation Consortium was established, which is a partnership between Iowa State's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, and the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. You know, a lot of people are getting involved in this effort. As you said, it's a cause that a lot of people can get excited about. What do you think the future of the monarch is, Donald?
We may have hit bottom, I hope, with the monarch butterfly, that the bad weather in Mexico, the droughts in Texas and Oklahoma, the lack of habitat in the upper Midwest, all of these things are going to be come and go, but it's getting more attention. So maybe we've hit the bottom and we can build from here. But replacing the milkweeds that have been lost out of field crops is going to be a big issue, and it's going to take a national effort. It's not something that we can do county by county. If there were a national initiative for this to restore milkweeds, it would certainly go a long way in bringing back what the monarchs need.
We'll open up the floor to questions here for a few minutes on insect topics. We've got a microphone right up here if you want to stand up, come to the mic.
That'd be great. That cooled their enthusiasm.
Yeah, now you're on the spot.
Has there ever been a verifiable study on what genetically modified corn with BT toxin in it, what the pollen does when it falls on milkweed, and is that paralyzing the guts of the monarch caterpillars?
When genetically modified corn first came out, it was the BT toxin that was the concern, that somehow the proteins and the toxins that the plant is producing would fall on the milkweed and interact with the caterpillars that were feeding on the milkweed. Well, that's no longer a problem because we don't have milkweeds in cornfields, because the second modification was to make corn and soybeans resistant to glyphosate herbicide, and so we were able to eliminate those milkweeds that were nearby. Turned out the studies done here, Cornell and elsewhere, the amount of BT toxin in the pollen that was falling on the plants was not that great and wasn't really the concern. When we talk about genetically modified organisms and genetically modified corn and soybeans impacting monarchs, it's the Roundup Ready resistance to glyphosate that has changed the dynamic for us.
Like myself, a number of us are wondering what we could do in our yards to help. However, I have a little concern because milkweed is quite invasive. So I'm just today walking through the butterfly section. I saw a number of dishes with feed, water, and sugar, I assume. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Could that be successfully used?
A great question that opens up the favorite topic of entomologists, and that's the life cycle of insects. Butterflies have a complete life cycle, and those four stages of the life cycle are egg. What's next? Come on. Larva, followed by pupa, by an adult. So when you think about providing for the four stages of the life cycle of the development of the butterflies, you need a place for them to lay their eggs, which is going to be where the caterpillars will feed. That's why the monarch needs the milkweed, is because that's what the caterpillar eats. Now, in the adult stage, a sugar bowl or a bowl of Gatorade or a bowl of rotten fruit or even a moldy bird bath will provide moisture and some nutrients for them, but that sugar solution is for the adult stage. In order to raise them, we have to have a plant that the caterpillar will eat. So different butterflies have different host plants, and that's why we try to increase that diversity as much as we can.
All right, one more question, Reese.
What are butterflies' natural enemies?
Birds and semi-radiator grills. Come to mind as natural enemies. Most butterflies in the adult stage are capable of escaping predators, but every once in a while you'll see a bird that has caught one or a praying mantis that has caught one. The biggest threat, the biggest natural threat, not human threat, the biggest natural threat to caterpillar would be in the caterpillar stage, and it would not be predators, which is what most people think of something big that comes and eats it. It would be parasites, something little that lives inside the body of the caterpillar and ends up killing it. So parasites in the caterpillar are probably the bigger natural enemy.
Donald Lewis, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Charity.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and joining me now is Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Also, Associate Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University, Ken Holscher, is here today. Hello, Ken.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for being here today. And you can now join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We've got you covered for plants and bugs this hour. And we just heard a little bit of the program that we put on at Ryman Gardens in Ames this Wednesday afternoon. Thank you so much if you were in the audience on Wednesday. We had a great crowd and such a good time. It was a great venue. And Richard, thank you very much for being there.
You're welcome.
It was a really wonderful afternoon. So before we dive into questions, and of course, as I mentioned, we can cover you for plants or bugs this hour. Even though Donald Lewis is not here, Ken Holscher has got that covered. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. And Richard, I was looking back through some photos from about 3 years ago when we had that super early spring. The redbud trees were in bloom at this time of year. And of course, that set us us up for a terrible freeze,
right,
where we lost a lot of blossoms, we lost a lot of fruit crops that year. So although I've been shivering all week, are there benefits to this cool spring weather?
I think there is, because it prevents maybe some premature early growth. So I don't see that happening this year unless we have a long period of, let's say, above normal temperatures, and then we have a cold snap. But at this point, I think most plants are doing what they should be. They're starting to emerge from the ground as far as perennials, and the buds on most trees are still pretty dormant.
All right. And does that give us a little bit of added time for pruning and tasks like that that we may not have already gotten done?
Yes, it does. Because if they haven't started to leaf out yet, we can go out this weekend, next week. We can still do pruning of most trees and shrubs except oaks, and we should be just fine. I would say maybe another 2 weeks or so.
All right. And of course, we wait to plant most of the things in our gardens until after Mother's Day.
But we could start maybe this weekend with things like lettuce and spinach, radishes, that type of thing. We could start.
All right. That was what I was just about to ask. All right.
You're correct.
There are a few things we can get in the ground right now. The number to call with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And this is a question on the subject of butterflies, Ken, so I guess it's for you, from Linda in Cedar Falls. What is your opinion of celebrations such as weddings and other events using butterflies as to release a mass of butterflies in celebration?
Well, that's kind of a tough one, because you kind of get both sides of that issue. I can understand why some folks would not like that in terms of using them for a celebratory thing, that they'd rather see them basically, you know, in their natural type habitat. My thought is it would all depend upon, personally, how they handle those. If they're released, and by releasing them, it's the time of the year when they're going to be able to flourish and survive. If it's just for a singular type thing, I guess I would be somewhat opposed to that. I'm not necessarily sure why we need to start, you know, releasing things like that for weddings. But I realize now sometimes you can't throw rice anymore.
Right.
I can't throw bird seed anymore. I'm kind of the opinion you just kind of blow some bubbles and ring a little bell and tell the newlyweds congratulations. That's probably good enough.
All right. But if it's a native species and it's released at a time of year where its chances for survival are good, you don't have an objection?
No, I don't have a problem with that.
You know, a lot of kids like to raise butterflies, too. And a lot of classrooms do that as a project. And I'm curious, do you think that that makes an impact environmentally?
I don't know about environmentally. I think it makes an impact educationally if you do it right. And I think what you have to understand, number one, is why you're doing it for the most part and what the end game is. And by that, I'm talking about understanding what butterfly or moth you're trying to rear out. It's easy to do. Anybody can find a large caterpillar of any type. And if it's large and if it's basically done feeding, the only thing you really have to do is carry it through the next part of its life cycle, getting it to pupate, spin a cocoon, chrysalis, whatever, and then watch that emerge. But what I mean by the end game is, now what are you going to do when that adult butterfly or moth emerges? Are you timing this much like its own life cycle would be, so that when it emerges, you can let it go and it's going to be perfectly fine? Or are you going to try to rear this based on maybe your time, when you'd like to see it? You can do this. You can get them to emerge in the middle of the wintertime, but then what do you do with them?
Right.
If you take them outside and let them go, they're going to flap their wings about two or three times, and that's going to be it.
So that might be an issue with school groups trying to do it. They need to time it to a time of year when the butterflies can be released?
They do, and the education part of that also is kids, especially young kids, like to see immediate results. They want to raise this thing from a caterpillar to the adult butterfly in a short amount of time. And the education comes in saying, no, that's not how that life cycle works. That most of the time, what they're going to do is spend the winter in that pupal stage or that cocoon or chrysalis. And so you have to wait a long period of time, get through the winter, And then the following spring is when that adult's going to emerge. But that's part of the learning process and understanding life cycles and understanding the difference between, you know, a cold-blooded animal versus a warm-blooded animal and why they have to do that and how their life cycle is timed basically to temperature and food supply when they do emerge. So I think there's an educational part that first has to come before you actually go through all of that.
All right, let's turn to a plant question. Go to the phones. Tom is on the line in Winterset. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, we all gardeners know or learn somehow that you can't plant very much of anything underneath a walnut tree if you want it to live.
Right.
So if I cut the walnut tree down, can I rehabilitate the soil? And if so, how?
Well, the walnut tree does produce a compound. It's called juglone. It does inhibit the growth of some plants, but not all, okay? So many shade-tolerant plants will grow underneath a walnut tree. Now, there are some vegetables that will not, for example, tomatoes. But on the other hand, green beans are not affected. So it's not everything. As far as removing the tree, if you do, I think within a year or two, everything should be fine in that this compound will eventually break down. The plants will have plenty of sun and there won't be any root competition. So I'm thinking the plant should be fine.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Susan is on the line in Windsor Heights. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Follow-up question for you, Mr. Giron. I called a couple weeks ago about replacing a pine. You recommended a Cleveland ornamental pear. And I may have gotten confused about your answer because you were also talking about columnar trees. The photos that I've seen of the Cleveland ornamental pear are not columnar. Did I misunderstand? So the Cleveland ornamental pear is more round in shape.
Well, I would say they are more upright than round.
Okay.
And they might get to be maybe 25, 30 feet tall.
Okay.
They might get to be 20 feet wide. So they're not perfectly round. They're more upright a little bit.
All right. More
oval, maybe, is a better term.
Okay.
But they're a nice ornamental tree. They have the white flowers in spring. They have the dark, shiny green foliage. And they're fairly easy to grow.
That's great. Second question. A neighbor told me that we should not plant a replacement tree within 70 feet of where that pine tree was. We had the stump ground up. It's all gone. Is this true? Should we pick another spot for a pear, for this Cleveland ornamental pear?
Not true. You can't plant directly where the tree was, but you can maybe move 4 or 5 feet from that site and plant another tree. No problem.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for the clarification.
All right, Susan, thanks a lot for your call. Yep. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question from Anne. She says, I live in Polk County, and we've not yet had the emerald ash borer, but it is in adjacent counties. I have a large ash tree that I would like to save. Should I start having it treated this spring?
We're looking at each other in terms of who's going to answer that question, to be quite honest with you.
The typical response is, if they haven't found the insect within 15 miles of your location, we do not recommend treating those trees. So if it's beyond that area, and at this point, they haven't found it yet in Polk County. They have found it in northern Story County. They have found it in the city of Boone. But Polk County is still beyond that 15-mile distance, so we would say probably no.
All right, but pay attention to the news.
Yes, because
yes, very much so.
Because just recently they found it in Clinton.
Really?
Okay. And Clinton County. And so it was basically in the news as far as radio, newspapers. So when it's found in Polk County, it's going to be on the news, definitely.
Yeah. Yes, and especially Polk County, it will be everywhere.
Yes.
We will know. All right, 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Glenn is on the line next. Hi, Glenn.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I was wondering about if there's a has been a significant decline in the bumblebee populations in the state.
I think that's a tough question to answer, well, yeah, I'm guessing. But
honest answers, I'm not really sure, because nobody's out there doing surveys of bumblebee populations, at least not in our department, and I'm not sure that anybody else is doing that. I have heard from, I take a lot of calls over the course of a given year, and I have on occasion over the last year or two taken some calls from folks asking that same thing, specifically about the bumblebee population. So I don't know. I can't understand why that might be if their numbers are down. Taking a look at my particular property and some of the things that I have in my landscape, that most years I would see a few bumblebees working around. I haven't seen a lot. But again, I don't know if that's just something that I'm not seeing or if there's a definite problem there. But as far as I know, nobody's counting numbers, so I don't know.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems like they're a significant pollinator for the state, and over the course of 25 years in our location, which is pretty rural, that there just aren't the numbers that there used to be.
True. They are a valuable pollinator. There's a lot of other bees out there that are valuable pollinators as well, and I think there is a concern collectively in terms of all of those insects in terms of their populations now, their populations coming, you know, in the future, in what that actually means in terms of not only, you know, gardens and things, but also from a commercial standpoint as well. And I think it's something that there's going to be more research done. People are looking, but it's something we surely need to protect out there as our pollinators.
All right, Glenn, thank you so much for your call. And I mean, there are some pretty unpopular pollinators out there too. Do you think there's maybe a shifting view of being willing to live with pollinators? Not everybody loves bumblebees.
Well, that's all perspective, I guess. You know, you're talking to an entomologist here, so I love them all,
right?
To be quite honest with you. But
in your department, they're probably a lot more highly thought of than elsewhere.
But I've talked to a number of folks. It doesn't seem to matter what the insect is. To a lot of folks, one insect of one type is one too many.
Right.
And the way I approach this is by saying, you know, I never try to convince anybody that they need to love an insect of any type, but you know, you don't need to love something in order to appreciate it. And I think we need to understand that those insects out there are to be appreciated, even those that sometimes may inflict something that is a little bit painful to us.
All right. Next up, we've got Margaret on the line in the Quad Cities. Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, several years ago, I purchased 3 parsley plants at a local garden center, brought them home, put them in pots. And I was harvesting a couple of twigs to use for dinner, and I brought them in the house and was rinsing them off in the colander, and I found 2 caterpillars. So I rushed them back outside, put them back on the parsley, and they thrived. They defoliated the parsley, and then I read online that it was probably a black swallowtail. Well, we kind of protected them, and one of them did build a chrysalis, and it was underneath it. By this time, it had gone on a lawn chair, and so we put a little shade cloth over it, went on vacation, came back, and it was gone, and we had several of the black swallowtails in the yard after that, but I was just wondering, wouldn't that come in with the plant? I can't figure out how that life cycle works, that we would be... You know, I don't remember any butterflies around the yard before that.
I don't know for sure. It could have came in on the plants, but there's just a greater likelihood that it didn't.
Really?
I'm amazed how, well, not black swallowtails, but I have a small vegetable garden, and I plant usually certain standard things. One of the things that my wife always wants me to plant is some zucchini. Now, every year I have a problem with squash vine borers, and I have never, ever seen an adult squash vine borer out there laying eggs on any of my zucchini plants, but invariably they totally get infested with them. And so there's a likelihood that there were black swallowtails out there. They have a fairly large flight range, to be quite honest with you, like Number of insects, they have a tremendous ability to detect odors, which draws them to certain plant sources that they need to feed on or lay eggs on. So that could be a possibility out there with that. And who knows what was around your area, but it's kind of nice to see black swallowtails. And if you looked at the chrysalis that they produce kind of a neat one, that instead of the chrysalis hanging straight down, almost like, you think most butterfly chrysalises do. What the caterpillar will do right there towards the end when they're making that is they make a loop so that it's not dangling straight down, but it's held up at an angle. And the reason for that is when that adult butterfly emerges from a chrysalis, its wings are all crunched up in there. It's kind of weak. It can't fly. It's pretty vulnerable. And when they emerge, the black swallowtail, because that chrysalis is angled up, that emerging butterfly has a better chance of grabbing onto a substrate, crawling out of there, assisting crawling out of there so it can expand its wings and fly away. Whereas if that chrysalis is hanging straight down, many times that butterfly has a difficult time coming out of that. Sometimes it'll actually drop to the ground, and then it's kind of sitting duck for predators. So they're kind of a neat butterfly.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Huh? We need to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Margaret, thank you for your call. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa with me, Associate Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University, Ken Holscher, and ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron. You can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Ken Holscher, Associate Professor of Entomology at ISU. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions about plants or bugs. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And next up, we've got Mark in Iowa City. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, first I'd like to respond to the last caller. We had some parsley in pots on our deck last year, and we had three black swallowtail caterpillars on them, and they did defoliate, but we enjoyed watching them. We never got to see them create a chrysalis, but hopefully they did. My question is, I have a smaller, about a six-foot-tall white pine that was severely damaged by a white-tailed buck last fall before I got the fences up. I'm wondering if I cut that off below the damage, if it will regenerate or if I need to just take it out and replant.
Okay. The damage is basically probably 2-3 feet off the ground?
Correct.
Okay. Boy, if the damage is severe and you don't think that tree is going to survive as far as above the damage, I would probably replace it. Because that tree, the likelihood of that tree recovering, if you have to prune off, let's say, the upper two-thirds, I don't think it will. The odds are not very good. So
okay,
I'd be inclined to probably replace it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Mark. 866-780-9100. Neelam is on the line in Ames. Hi, Neelam.
Hi. Good morning. I have two questions and a small observation. I want to know where to get free milkweed seeds. And my second question is, do butterflies talk to each other as they fly, like some other birds do? And then the observation is that about 5 years ago, we had a garden, we had milkweed trees, milkweed plants and trees and stuff. One day I was going by the tree, and I thought the tree was damaged. I looked around, the whole thing was rust-colored. When I looked very carefully, it was full of monarch butterflies. I just wanted you to know.
I've seen that too, Neelam. It's just amazing, isn't it?
Absolutely. I will listen to your replies now. Thank you. Bye.
All right.
Okay. As far as milkweed seeds and plants, there are a number of companies that specialize in native plant materials. For example, there's Prairie Nursery in Wisconsin. Prairie Moon Nursery in Minnesota, and Ion Exchange in Harpers Ferry, Iowa. So they might have seeds and or plants.
All right. And do butterflies communicate with each other when they fly? That's a tough one. They don't honk like geese.
In fact, the caller said, do they talk to each other? Not like you and I are talking now. There are some insects that obviously make sounds as a form of communication. The cicadas that buzz up in the trees in the summertime and crickets chirping are two good examples. And in both of those cases, those sounds that those two insects make are produced by the males, and they're used to attract females for that. Now, butterflies don't make audible sounds like you and I think about, and they don't talk in that regard, but they have to communicate at times during the life with one another. They typically do that through odors. When it comes time for mating, for example, the female butterfly will typically produce an odorous molecule, a sex pheromone that is very, very specific. Only a male of that same species butterfly can detect that particular pheromone. He will basically follow that pheromone plume until he finds the female to mate with her. But while we may see a lot of butterflies of the same species all in the same place at the same time, you have to understand that they're basically individuals. There's no social life in the butterflies. They're just acting as individuals. So they don't really have to communicate as much as maybe some animals do, like you and I.
All right. And let's take another monarch question. This is from Mike in Northeast Iowa. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, as long as you've got some frequent guests on there, I don't think a lot of people know the life cycle of the monarch, that there's actually four life cycles in 1 year. The first three live for about 6 weeks, and the fourth one is set up to make the trip south. Maybe he could talk about that for a minute.
Sure, and Donald did mention that in the first segment of the show today, that we're raising the grandchildren of the monarch butterflies that go south. So can you fill in a little bit of that, Ken?
Sure. I think monarchs are one of those insects that I wished everybody knew something about. I teach an entomology class here, a beginning entomology class, and one of the projects I have the kids do is just simply provide me with a list of 10 insects that they think everybody in the United States should know something about. And then I provide them with my list, and one of the ones on my list is a monarch. Not simply because it's a nice, pretty butterfly and you can find it, but for what it does in terms of its migration. For something as small, as fragile as a monarch butterfly to do what it does in making its way essentially from central Iowa all the way down to a small little location down in Mexico. And it's not just the ones from Iowa that do that. All of the monarchs from the United States basically find their way down there. Now, a lot of animals, other animals migrate. We think of waterfowl, ducks and geese. They too travel tremendous ways, but most times what the young do is they learn that migratory route from their parents. Well, in the case of monarchs, they never learn that. If you think about it, they find their way to a place they've never been to before and find their way back. Those that find all their way back here to Iowa have never been to Iowa before, and yet they can do it. And the behavior involved with that, how they figure that out, like I said, is to me one of the more fascinating things. But the monarchs we have here in the late summer find their way down to Mexico. They overwinter. When you're tagging monarch butterflies like some people do here, you have to understand that you'll never get that same tag monarch back here in Iowa the next year. They'll go down to Mexico in the springtime. They'll start migrating back, but that generation never makes it back. Along the way, they will mate. Those adults will die. They kick the next generation out, which now proceeds to continue that migration back up here to Iowa, never having been here before. They get up here, and basically the same thing happens. And so Every direction they go, north or south every year, the monarchs that go there have never been there before. And I find that just a fascinating behavior.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons that people do feel such affection for monarchs, is that their journey is so miraculous.
It is. And I know there's a lot of concern about monarch populations nowadays. And I truly hope that, you know, we're not doing things to reduce that monarch population, because I think it's one of the treasures of the world, and if you ever get a chance to go down to some of those areas where they overwinter, it's just a sight to behold.
This is an email from Gene in Des Moines. He said, monarchs seem so fragile, but I assume they're adaptable, and clearly they've evolved, but I also assume they don't leave much of a fossil record. Do we know very much about the evolution of monarchs?
Specifically, no, not that I know of. You know, when you're talking about evolutionary history of a lot of insects, it's kind of tough to trace back. We can do it as a whole, I guess, for many animal groups. But obviously, the only records you have are fossil records. A lot of things don't fossilize very well, to be quite honest, with that. So there's not much, I don't think there's not much in there's not much available in that fossil record or their evolutionary history monarchs.
Well, and so many animals adapt very well to the changes that humans have made to their environment and their landscape. But Gene's concern is also that humans are changing the environment so quickly that even though these insects clearly are adaptable, we're moving too fast for them.
Well, yes, in some regards. And when you take an animal like a monarch butterfly, they are adaptable, but you have to be careful when you have something that is so specific in terms of its food source. It's one thing if an insect or a butterfly has multiple food sources, that if something happens to one food source, they still have others that they can utilize. But in the case of monarchs, we don't. They have a singular food source, so everything really hinges on that in terms of milkweeds. And so you can kind of track probably the potential for monarch populations, you know, in the future by simply tracking milkweed populations, because they go hand in hand.
All right. And back to a plant question. And Richard, I think this might become the most popular plant question of the season. This is from Tom in Mystic. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
My question is, my wife has ordered a lot of these monarch packets, and then she gave them away to a lot of friends. What is the best way to plant the seed, when to plant it, and, you know, how deep?
Well, basically, I would destroy the existing vegetation. You can do that by tillage or Roundup. Then I would work up the soil, and I would plant the seeds in the spring or possibly in late fall, either one, and let them do their thing. Just kind of very lightly kind of rake them into the soil, and they should germinate.
So many people want to plant milkweed now, and it is a little bit humorous because it used to be everywhere. There was no thought to planting it,
right?
And trying to help it thrive because it seemed to be all over the place.
And I think if you're trying to maybe plant a few, your best option would be to buy plants. You can buy plants. Some of the milkweed family is a pretty big family. Some are actually very nice ornamentals, like the butterfly weed. And so you can find these at garden centers. Some of the companies do have seedling plants or barewort plants, so it might be a little bit easier to go with plants or seedlings.
All right, and a lot more places are selling
yes.
plants or seedlings, which was something that we didn't see a few years ago.
In fact, I noticed I was looking at some sites yesterday. Some of the companies are sold out of some of these plants because of all the demand. So,
and I know that there have been a lot of local nature centers and places giving away seedlings as well. So I think that even if you can't get what you're looking for this year, clearly this is a movement,
right,
and they're going to be more available in the future.
Right.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Donna is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Donna.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
I don't have a question. I just had a comment. He was talking earlier about the trees are starting to bud out in the bushes. My forsythia plant is blooming,
mm-hmm.
my bush.
Mm-hmm.
So I just was going to make that comment.
Well, happy spring. That's great.
They're one of the first things to bloom in the spring, typically, usually in central Iowa, early to mid-April. But I also noticed a witch hazel blooming yesterday, too, a Vernal witch hazel. They typically bloom February, March, so blooming right on time.
All right. I also remember one of the springs in recent years where we had a very cool spring. Once the blossoms came, they stayed beautiful for a long time because of the cool weather.
Right, right. If you have some nice, sunny, cool weather, they'll persist for maybe a couple of weeks. But if you have warm, windy, sunny weather, they may just go in a few days.
All right, so. But we'll still have warmth and sun, so that's
yeah.
a
yes.
There's a trade-off.
There's trade-offs, yes.
All right. Marsha's on the line next in Clear Lake. Hi, Marsha.
Hi. My question is, you said that we could do pruning on bushes and shrubs this weekend. Would that be a good idea for lilacs?
Right, you can still prune those. And as far as pruning them, it really kind of depends upon what you need to do. If you need to do some really severe, heavy pruning, what I would suggest is doing it now. And I would suggest taking out some of the old growth near the ground, maybe several of the shoots, maybe 3, 4, or 5, and getting rid of them completely. Now, if you just need to do some light pruning to shape it up, then I would let it go ahead and bloom and then prune it immediately after blooming.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And here's another pruning question from Steve in Windsor Heights. I have a 12-foot, 5-year-old Dawn Redwood that experienced lower branch rutting season damage last fall. Mm. Is it too late in the season to prune?
No, it's not. You probably have another 2 weeks or so. And what they might want to try doing is maybe next fall, going out there with some sturdy wooden fence posts and pound those into the ground around the tree so they can't get in there to do that again.
Okay, and maybe they can scrape their antlers on the fence posts.
Right.
Instead. Yep. This is from Bill in Des Moines. The pollen index for trees has been listed as very high for at least 2 weeks. When will trees, specifically poplars, stop causing allergy sufferers like me problems? And by the way, isn't this happening early this year?
I'm not sure on the poplars. I would think they're going to be in full bloom in April, early May, would be my guess. So I'm not positive on that.
All right. and I think sometimes we always feel like something that's unpleasant comes sooner than it should. Julie's on the line next in Waverly. Hi, Julie.
Hi. How are you guys?
Good. What's your question?
Well, we started an experiment in our kitchen. And my family thinks I'm kind of crazy. It's just a bucket, and we started some red worms composting. And I guess whatever we're doing is working because they're multiplying. So I guess my idea is just take a handful of these worms, of course, when it gets a little warmer, but throwing them in my stinky outdoor compost pile.
Okay. Okay.
And my husband thought he read where red worms can be invasive.
I don't believe they're native. And so there is some questions about...
They might not survive the winter unless they dug way in the ground, but...
But also the large night crawlers that we see in Iowa,
right,
are not really native either. So a number of species have been introduced to the area that have become basically naturalized.
So it wouldn't be harmful if I threw them in my compost to see if they did something.
Well, that's up to you. I guess I don't see a major problem, no.
It just stinks really bad, but the inside compost bin doesn't smell so bad.
Yeah, they do a good job.
Yeah, okay. That's all I wanted to know. Thanks.
All right, Julie, thank you so much for your call. And last call of, well, actually, you know what? I'm afraid that was our last call of the day now that I look at the clock. But thank you so much for being here today, Richard Duran.
Thank you.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran. And Ken Holscher, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Ken Holscher, Associate Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. And again, thank you so much to everybody who came out to the open house at Ryman Gardens in Ames on Wednesday. It was a lot of fun. It was a great event, and we will do it again in the future. So if you missed out, don't give up. Maybe next spring we'll have another opportunity. But thank you for listening today. Sorry we couldn't get to all of the questions today, but of course we will be back with Horticulture Friday again next week. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Also, assistance from Julia Davis. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime. We'd love to hear your thoughts on things you hear on the air on Talk of Iowa. We would love to get your suggestions for things you would like to hear on the air. People you know who have great stories to tell, send us information. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Have a great weekend.